Side 4. Chapter 10. The Evidence of the Italian.
"And now," said Poirot with a twinkle in his eye, "we will delight the heart of Monsieur Bouc and see the Italian."
Antonio Froscarelli came into the dining car with a swift, cat-like tread. His face beamed. It was a typical Italian face, sunny-looking and swarthy. He spoke French well and fluently, with only a slight accent.
"Your name is Antonio Foscarelli?"
"Yes, monsieur."
"You are, I see, a naturalized American subject."
The American grinned.
"Yes, monsieur, it is better for my business."
"And you are an agent for Ford Motor Cars?"
"Yes. You see..."
A voluble exposition followed. At the end of it, anything that the three men did not know about Foscarelli's business methods, his journeys, his income, and his opinion of the United States and most European countries seemed a negligible factor. This was not a man who had to have information dragged from him. It gushed out. His good-natured, polished face beamed with satisfaction, as, with a last eloquent gesture, he paused and wiped his forehead with a handkerchief.
"So, you see," he said, "I do big business. I am up to date. I understand salesmanship, eh?"
"You have been in the United States, then, for the last 10 years, on and off?"
"Yes, monsieur. Ah, well, do I remember the day I first took the boat, to go to America, so far away, ah? Oh, my mother, my little sister, eh?"
Poirot cut short the flood of reminiscence.
"During your sojourn in the United States, did you ever come across the deceased?"
"Never. But I know the type. Oh, yes."
He snapped his fingers expressively.
"It is very respectable, very well dressed, eh? But underneath it is all wrong. Out of my experience, I should say he was the big crook. I give you my opinion for what it's worth."
Your opinion is quite right," said Poirot dryly. "Ratchet was Cassetti, the kidnapper?"
"What did I tell you? I have learned to be very acute, to read the face. It is necessary, eh? Only in America do they teach you the proper way to sell."
"You remember the Armstrong case?"
"Well, I do not quite remember. But her name, yes. It was a little girl, a baby, was it not?"
"Yes, a very tragic affair."
The Italian seemed the first person to demur to this view.
"Ah, well, these things, they can happen," he said philosophically. "In a great civilization such as America..."
Poirot cut him short.
"Did you ever come across any members of the Armstrong family?"
"No, I do not think so. It is difficult to say. I will give you some figures. Now, last year alone, I sold..."
"Monsieur, pray confine yourself to the point."
The Italian's hands flung themselves out in a gesture of apology.
"Eh, 1,000 pardons.
Now tell me, if you please, your exact movements last night from dinner onwards."
"With pleasure. I stay here as long as I can. It is more amusing. I talk to the American gentleman at my table. He sells typewriter ribbons. Then I go back to my compartment. It is empty. The miserable John Bull, who shares it with me, is away attending to his master. At last he comes back, a very long face as usual. He will not talk. Says yes and no. Ah! A miserable race, the English, not sympathetic. He sits in the corner very stiff, reading a book. Then the conductor comes and makes our beds."
"Numbers 4 and 5? Murmured Poirot.
"Exactly, the end compartment. Mine is the upper berth. I get up there, I smoke, I read. The little Englishman has, I think, the toothache. He gets out a little bottle of stuff that smells very strong. He lies in bed and groans. Presently, I sleep. Whenever I wake, I hear him groaning."
"And do you know if he left the carriage at all during the night?"
"No, I do not think so. That I should hear. The light from the corridor, one wakes up automatically thinking it is the customs examination at some frontier."
"Did he ever speak of his master, or ever express any animus against him?"
"I tell you, he did not speak. He was not sympathetic. A fish."
"You smoke, you say, a pipe, cigarettes, cigars?"
"Cigarettes only."
Poirot proffered him one, which he accepted.
"Have you ever been in Chicago?"
inquired Monsieur Bouc.
"Oh, yes, a fine city. But I know best New York, Washington, Detroit.
You have been to the States, no? Ah, you should go. Poirot pushed a sheet of paper across to him.
If you will sign this and put your permanent address, please.
The Italian wrote with a flourish. Then he rose. His smile was as engaging as ever.
That is all? You do not require me further? Ah, good day to you, monsieur. I wish we could get out of the snow. I have an appointment in Milan.
He shook his head sadly.
Oh, I shall lose the business.
He departed. Poirot looked at his friend.
He's been a long time in America, said Monsieur Bouc, and he is an Italian, huh? And Italians use the knife, huh? And they are great liars, huh? I do not like Italians, huh?
Ça se voit, said Poirot with a smile. Well, it may be that you are right. But I will point out to you, my friend, that there is absolutely no evidence against that man.
And what about the psychology? Do not Italians stab, huh?
Assuredly, said Poirot. Especially in the heat of a quarrel. But this is a different kind of crime. I have the little idea, my friend, that this is a crime very carefully planned and staged. It is a far-sighted, long-headed crime. It is not, how shall I express it, a Latin crime. It is a crime that shows traces of a cool, resourceful, deliberate brain. I think an Anglo-Saxon brain.
He picked up the last two passports.
Let us now, he said, see Miss Mary Debenham.
Chapter 11. The Evidence of Miss Debenham. When Mary Debenham entered the dining car, she confirmed Poirot's previous estimate of her. Very neatly dressed in a little black suit with a French grey shirt, the smooth waves of her dark head were neat and unruffled. Her manner was as calm and unruffled as her hair. She sat down opposite Poirot and Monsieur Bouc and looked at them inquiringly.
Your name is Mary Hermione Debenham, and you are 26 years of age, began Poirot.
Yes.
English?
Yes.
Will you be so kind, mademoiselle, as to write down your permanent address on this piece of paper?
She complied. Her writing was clear and legible.
And now, mademoiselle, what have you to tell us of the affair last night?
I'm afraid I have nothing to tell you. I went to bed and slept.
Does it distress you very much, mademoiselle, that a crime has been committed on this train?
The question was clearly unexpected. Her grey eyes widened a little.
I don't quite understand you.
Well, it was a perfectly simple question that I asked you, mademoiselle. I will repeat it. Are you very much distressed that a crime should have been committed on this train?
I have not really thought about it from that point of view.
No, I cannot say that I'm at all distressed. Oh, a crime, it is all in the day's work to you, eh?
It's naturally an unpleasant thing to have happened, said Mary Debenham quietly.
Oh, you are very Anglo-Saxon, mademoiselle. Vous n'éprouvez pas d'émotion?
She smiled a little.
I am afraid I cannot have hysterics to prove my sensibility. After all, people die every day.
Oh, they die, yes, but murder is a little more rare.
Oh, certainly.
You are not acquainted with the dead man?
No, I saw him for the first time when lunching here yesterday.
And how did he strike you?
I hardly noticed him.
He did not impress you as an evil personality?
She shrugged her shoulders slightly.
Really, I cannot say I thought about it.
Poirot looked at her keenly.
You are, I think, a little bit contemptuous of the way I prosecute my inquiries, he said with a twinkle.
Not so, you think, would an English inquiry be conducted. There, everything would be cut and dried. It would be all kept to the facts, eh? A well-ordered business. But I, mademoiselle, have my little originalities, eh?
I look first at my witness, I sum up his or her character, and I frame my questions accordingly.
Just a little minute ago, I am asking questions of a gentleman who wants to tell me all his ideas on every subject.
Well, him I keep strictly to the point. I want him to answer yes or no, this or that. And then you come. I see at once that you will be orderly and methodical.
You will confine yourself to the matter in hand. Your answers will be brief and to the point. And because, mademoiselle, human nature is perverse, I ask of you quite different questions. I ask what you feel, what you thought. It does not please you, this method.
If you will forgive my saying so, it seems somewhat of a waste of time. Whether or not I liked Mr. Ratchet's face does not seem likely to be helpful in finding out who killed him.
Do you know who the man Ratchet really was, mademoiselle? She nodded.
Mrs. Hubbard has been telling everyone.
And what do you think of the Armstrong affair?
It's quite abominable, said the girl crisply.
Poirot looked at her thoughtfully.
You are travelling from Baghdad, I believe, Miss Debenham.
Yes.
To London?
Yes.
And what have you been doing in Baghdad?
I have been acting as governess to two children.
Are you returning to your post after your holiday?
I'm not sure.
Why is that?
Baghdad is rather out of things. I think I should prefer a post in London, if I can hear of a suitable one.
I see. Oh, well, I thought perhaps you might be going to be married.
Miss Debenham did not reply. She raised her eyes and looked Poirot full in the face. The glance said plainly, "You are impertinent."
What is your opinion of the lady who shares your compartment, Miss Olson?
Well, she seems a pleasant, simple creature.
In what colour is her dressing gown?
Mary Debenham stared.
A kind of brownish colour. Natural wool.
Ah, I may mention without indiscretion, I hope, that I noticed the colour of your dressing gown on the way from Aleppo to Stamboul. A pale mauve, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
And have you any other dressing gown, mademoiselle? A scarlet dressing gown, for example?
No, that is not mine.
Poirot leant forward. He was like a cat pouncing on a mouse.
Whose, then?
The girl drew back a little, startled.
I don't know. What do you mean? You do not say, no, I have no such thing. You say, that is not mine, meaning that such a thing does belong to someone else. She nodded. Someone else on this train.
Yes.
Whose is it? Well, I told you just now, I don't know.
I woke up this morning about 5 o'clock with the feeling that the train had been standing still for a long time. I opened the door and looked out into the corridor, thinking we might be at a station. I saw someone in a scarlet kimono somewhere down the corridor.
And you don't know who it was, eh? Was she fair, or dark, or grey-haired?
Well, I can't say. She had on a shingle cap, and I only saw the back of her head.
And in build?
Tallish and slim, I should judge, but it's difficult to say. The kimono was embroidered with dragons.
Yes. Yes, that is right. Dragons.
He was silent a minute.
He murmured to himself, I cannot understand. I cannot understand. None of this makes sense.
Then, looking up, he said,
I need not keep you further, mademoiselle.
Oh. She seemed rather taken aback, but rose promptly. In the doorway, however, she hesitated a minute and then came back. The Swedish lady, Miss Olson, is it? Seems rather worried. She says you told her she was the last person to see this man alive. She thinks, I believe, that you suspect her on that account. Can't I tell her that she has made a mistake? Really, you know, she is the kind of creature who wouldn't hurt a fly.
She smiled a little as she spoke.
What time was it that she went to fetch the aspirin from Mrs. Hubbard?
Just after 10:30.
She was away how long?
About 5 minutes.
Did she leave the compartment again during the night?
No.
Poirot turned to the doctor.
Could Ratchet have been killed as early as that?
The doctor shook his head.
Then I think you can reassure your friend, mademoiselle.
Thank you.
She smiled suddenly at him, a smile that invited sympathy.
She's like a sheep, you know. She gets anxious and bleats.
She turned and went out. Chapter 12. The Evidence of the German Lady's Maid. Monsieur Bouc was looking at his friend curiously.
I do not quite understand you, mon vieux. You were trying to do what?
I was searching for a flaw, my friend.
A flaw?
Yes. in the armour of a young lady's self-possession. I wish to shake her sang froid. Did I succeed? I do not know. But I know this. She did not expect me to tackle the matter as I did.
You suspect her, said Monsieur Bouc slowly. But why? She seems a very charming young lady, the last person in the world to be mixed up in a crime of this kind.
I agree, said Constantine. She is cold. She has not emotions. She would not stab a man. She would sue him in the law courts.
Poirot sighed.
You must, both of you, get rid of your obsession that this is an unpremeditated and sudden crime. As for the reason why I suspect Miss Debenham, there are two. One is because something that I overheard, and that you do not as yet know.
He retailed to them the curious interchange of phrases he had overheard on the journey from Aleppo.
That is curious, certainly, said Monsieur Bouc when he had finished. It needs explaining, and if it means what you suspect it means, then they are both of them in it together, she and the stiff Englishman.
Poirot nodded.
And that is just what is not borne out by the facts, he said. See you. If they were both in this together, what should we expect to find? That each of them would provide an alibi for the other, is that not so?
But no, that does not happen.
Miss Debenham's alibi is provided by a Swedish woman whom she has never seen before. And Colonel Arbuthnot's alibi is vouched for by McQueen, the dead man's secretary.
No, that solution of the puzzle is too easy. But you said there was another reason for your suspicions of her,
Monsieur Bouc reminded him. Poirot smiled.
But that is only psychological. I ask myself, is it possible for Miss Debenham to have planned this crime? Behind this business, I am convinced that there is a cool, intelligent, resourceful brain. Miss Debenham answers to that description.
Monsieur Bouc shook his head.
No, I think you are wrong, my friend. I do not see that young English girl as a criminal.
Ah, well, said Poirot, picking up the last passport. To the final name on our list. Hildegard Schmidt, lady's maid.
Summoned by the attendant, Hildegard Schmidt came into the restaurant car and stood waiting, respectfully. Poirot motioned her to sit down. She did so, folding her hands and waiting placidly till he questioned her. She seemed a placid creature altogether, eminently respectable, perhaps not over-intelligent. Poirot's methods with Hildegard Schmidt were a complete contrast to his handling of Mary Debenham. He was at his kindest and most genial, setting the woman at her ease. Then, having got her to write down her name and address, he slid gently into his questions. The interview took place in German.
"We want to know as much as possible about what happened last night," he said. "We know that you cannot give us much information bearing on the crime itself, but you may have seen or heard something that, while conveying nothing to you, may be valuable to us. You understand?"
She did not seem to. Her broad, kindly face remained set in its expression of placid stupidity as she answered,
"I do not know anything, monsieur."
"Well, for instance, you know that your mistress sent for you last night?"
"That, yes."
"Do you remember the time?"
"I do not, monsieur. I was asleep. You see, when the attendant came and told me."
"Oh, yes, yes.
Was it usual for you to be sent for in this way?"
"It was not unusual, monsieur. The gracious lady often required attention at night. She did not sleep well."
"Eh bien, then, you received the summons and you got up. Did you put on a dressing gown?"
"No, monsieur, I put on a few clothes. I would not like to go into Her Excellency in my dressing gown."
"And yet it is a very nice dressing gown. Scarlet, is it not?"
She stared at him.
"It is a dark blue flannel dressing gown, monsieur."
"Ah, continue. A little pleasantry on my part, that is all. So, you went along to Madame la Princesse, and what did you do when you got there?"
"I gave her massage, monsieur, and then I read aloud. I do not read aloud very well, but Her Excellency says that is all the better.
So it sends her better to sleep.
Then she became sleepy, monsieur. She told me to go. So I closed the book, and I returned to my own compartment.
Do you know what time that was?
No, monsieur.
Well, how long had you been with Madame la Princesse?
About half an hour, monsieur.
Good. Continue.
First, I fetched Her Excellency an extra rug from my compartment. It was very cold in spite of the heating. I arranged the rug over her, and she wished me good night. I poured her out some mineral water. Then I turned out the light and left her.
And then?
But there is nothing more, monsieur. I returned to my carriage and went to sleep.
And you met no one in the corridor?
No, monsieur.
You did not, for instance, see a lady in a scarlet kimono with dragons on it?
Her mild eyes bulged at him.
No, indeed, monsieur. There was nobody about except the attendant. Everyone was asleep.
But did you see the conductor?
Yes, monsieur.
And what was he doing?
He came out of one of the compartments, monsieur.
What?
Monsieur Bouc leaned forward.
Which one?
Hildegard Schmidt looked frightened again, and Poirot cast a reproachful glance at his friend.
Naturally, he said.
The conductor often has to answer bells at night.
Do you remember which compartment it was?
It was about the middle of the coach, monsieur. Two or three doors from Madame la Princesse.
Ah, tell us, if you please, exactly where this was and what happened.
Well, he nearly ran into me, monsieur. It was when I was returning from my compartment to that of the princess with a rug.
And he came out of the compartment and almost collided with you? In which direction was he going?
Towards me, monsieur. He apologized and passed on down the corridor towards the dining car. A bell began ringing, but I do not think he answered it.
She paused and then said,
I do not understand. How is it...
Poirot spoke reassuringly.
No, it is just a question of times, he said.
All a matter of routine.
This poor conductor, he seems to have had a busy night, eh? First waking you and then answering bells, eh?
It was not the same conductor who woke me, monsieur. It was another one.
Ah, another one? Had you seen him before?
No, monsieur.
Ah, do you think you would recognize him if you saw him?
I think so, monsieur.
Poirot murmured something in Monsieur Bouc's ear. The latter got up and went to the door to give an order. Poirot was continuing his questions in an easy, friendly manner.
Have you ever been to America, Frau Schmidt?
Never, monsieur. It must be a fine country.
You have heard, perhaps, of who this man who was killed really was, huh? That he was responsible for the death of a little child?
Yes. I have heard, monsieur. It was abominable, wicked. The good God should not allow such things. We are not so wicked as that in Germany.
Tears had come into the woman's eyes. Her strong, motherly soul was moved.
It was an abominable crime, said Poirot gravely.
He drew a scrap of cambric from his pocket and handed it to her.
Is this your handkerchief, Frau Schmidt?
There was a moment's silence as the woman examined it. She looked up after a minute. The colour had mounted a little in her face.
Ah, no, indeed, it is not mine, monsieur.
Ah, well, it has the initial H, you see. That is why I thought it was yours.
Ah, monsieur, it is a lady's handkerchief, that. A very expensive handkerchief embroidered by hand. It comes from Paris, I should say.
It is not yours, and you do not know whose it is?
I? Oh, no, monsieur.
Of the three listening, only Poirot caught the nuance of hesitation in the reply. Monsieur Bouc whispered in his ear. Poirot nodded and said to the woman,
The three sleeping car attendants are coming in.
Will you be so kind as to tell me which is the one you met last night as you were going with the rug to the princess?
The three men entered. Pierre Michel, the big blonde conductor of the Athens-Paris coach, and the stout, burly conductor of the Bucharest one. Hildegard Schmidt looked at them and immediately shook her head.
No, monsieur,
she said. None of these is the man I saw last night.
Ah, but these are the only conductors on the train. You must be mistaken.
No, I am quite sure, monsieur. These are all tall, big men. The one I saw was small and dark. He had a little moustache. His voice, when he said pardon, was weak like a woman's. Indeed, I remember him very well, monsieur.
Chapter 13. Summary of the passenger's evidence.
A small, dark man with a womanish voice, said Monsieur Bouc.
The three conductors and Hildegard Schmidt had been dismissed. Monsieur Bouc made a despairing gesture.
But I understand nothing. But nothing of all this. The enemy that this wretched spoke of, he was then on the train after all, but where is he now? How can he have vanished into thin air, eh? My head, it whirls. Say something then, my friend, I implore you. Show me how the impossible can be possible.
Ha ha, it is a good phrase that, said Poirot.
The impossible cannot have happened, therefore the impossible must be possible, in spite of appearances. Explain to me then quickly what actually happened on the train last night.
Oh, I am not a magician, mon cher. I am, like you, a very puzzled man. This affair advances in a very strange manner.
It does not advance at all. It stays where it was.
Poirot shook his head.
No, 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 that is not true. No, we are more advanced. We know certain things. We have heard the evidence of the passengers.
And what has that told us? Nothing at all.
No, I would not say that, my friend.
Well, I exaggerate, perhaps. The American hard man and the German maid, yes, they have added something to our knowledge. That is to say, they have made the whole business more unintelligible than it was.
No, 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 said Poirot soothingly.
Monsieur Bouc turned upon him.
Oh, speak then. Let us hear the wisdom of Hercule Poirot.
Did I not tell you that I was, like you, a very puzzled man?
But at least we can face our problem, huh? We can arrange such facts as we have with order and method.
Pray continue, monsieur, said Dr. Constantine.
Poirot cleared his throat and straightened a piece of blotting paper.
Let us review the case as it stands at this moment. First, there are certain indisputable facts. This man, Ratchet, or Cassetti, was stabbed in 12 places and died last night. That is fact one.
Oh, yes, I grant it to you. I grant it, mon vieux, said Monsieur Bouc with a gesture of irony.
But Hercule Poirot was not at all put out. He continued calmly.
I will pass over for the moment certain rather peculiar appearances which Dr. Constantine and I have already discussed together. Now I will come to them presently. The next fact of importance to my mind is the time of the crime.
Well, that again is one of the few things we do know, said Monsieur Bouc. The crime was committed at 1:15 this morning. Everything goes to show that that was so.
Ah, but not everything. You exaggerate. There is certainly a fair amount of evidence to support that view.
Well, I'm glad you admit that, at least.
Poirot went on calmly, unperturbed by the interruption.
We have before us three possibilities. One, that the crime was committed, as you say, at 1:15. Now, this is supported by the evidence of the German woman, Hildegard Schmidt. It agrees with the evidence of Dr. Constantine. Possibility two, the crime was committed later, and the evidence of the watch was deliberately faked.
And possibility three?
The crime was committed earlier, and the evidence faked for the same reason as above. Now, if we accept possibility one as the most likely to have occurred, and the one supported by most evidence, we must also accept certain facts arising from it. So, to begin with, if the crime was committed at 1:15, the murderer cannot have left the train, and the question arises, where is he and who is he? Now, to begin with, let us examine the evidence carefully. We first hear of the existence of this man, the small, dark man with a womanish voice, from the man Hartmann. He says that Ratchet told him of this person and employed him to watch out for the man. But there is no evidence to support this. We have only Hardman's word for it. Let us next examine the question, is Hardman the person he pretends to be, an operative of a New York detective agency?
Now, what to my mind is so interesting in this case is that we have none of the facilities afforded to the police. We cannot investigate the bona fides of any of these people. We have to rely solely on deduction. And that, to me, makes the matter very much more interesting. No, this is no routine work. It is a matter of the intellect. I ask myself, can we accept Hartmann's account of himself? I make my decision, and I answer, yes. I am of the opinion that we can accept Hartmann's account of himself.
You rely on the intuition, what the Americans call the hunch, said Dr. Constantine.
Oh, not at all. I regard the probabilities. Hartmann is traveling with a false passport. That will at once make him an object of suspicion. The first thing that the police will do when they arrive upon the scene is to detain Hartmann and cable as to whether his account of himself is true. In the case of many of the passengers, to establish their bona fides will be difficult. In most cases, it will probably not be attempted, especially since there seems nothing in the way of suspicion attaching to them. But in Hartmann's case, it is simple. Either he is the person he represents himself to be, or he is not. Therefore, I say that all will prove to be in order.
So you acquit him of suspicion?
Oh, not at all. You misunderstand me. For all I know, any American detective might have his own private reasons for wishing to murder Ratchet. No. What I am saying is that I think we can accept Hartmann's own account of himself. Now, this story, then, that he tells of Ratchet seeking him out and employing him is not unlikely, and is most probably, though not of course certainly, true. If we are going to accept it as true, we must see if there is any confirmation of it. We must find it in rather an unlikely place. In the evidence of Hildegard Schmidt. Her description of the man she saw in wagonly uniform tallies exactly. Is there any further confirmation of these two stories? There is. There is the button found in her compartment by Mrs. Hubbard, and there is also another corroborating statement which you may not have noticed.
Oh, what is that?
The fact that both Colonel Arbuthnot and Hector McQueen mentioned that the conductor passed the carriage. They attach no importance to the fact, but, monsieur, Pierre Michel has declared that he did not leave his seat except on certain specified occasions, none of which would have taken him down to the far end of the coach, past the compartment in which Arbuthnot and McQueen were sitting. Therefore, this story, the story of a small, dark man with a womanish voice dressed in wagonly uniform, rests on the testimony, direct or indirect, of four witnesses.
Now, one small point, said Dr. Constantine. If Hildegard Smith's story is true, how is it that the real conductor did not mention having seen her when he came to answer Mrs. Hubbard's bell?
That is explained, I think. When he arrived to answer Mrs. Hubbard, the maid was in with our mistress. When she finally returned to her compartment, the conductor was in with Mrs. Hubbard.
Monsieur Bouc had been waiting with difficulty until they had finished.
Yes, yes, my friend, he said impatiently to Poirot. But whilst I admire your caution, your method of advancing a step at a time, I submit that you have not yet touched the point at issue. We are all agreed that this person exists. The point is, where did he go?
Poirot shook his head reprovingly.
You are in error. You are inclined to put the cart before the horse. Before I ask myself where did this man vanish to, I ask myself, did such a man really exist? Because, you see, if the man were an invention, a fabrication, how much easier to make him disappear? So, I try to establish first that there really is such a flesh-and-blood person.
And having arrived at the fact that there is a bien, where is he now, huh?
Now, there are only two answers to that, mon cher. Either he is still hidden on the train in a place of such extraordinary ingenuity that we cannot even think of it, or else he is, as one might say, two persons. That is, he is both himself, the man feared by Monsieur Ratchet, and the passenger on the train so well disguised that Monsieur Ratchet did not recognize him. It is an idea, that, said Monsieur Bouc, his face lighting up. Then it clouded over again.
But there is one objection. Poirot took the words out of his mouth.
The height of the man? It is that you would say, eh? Now, but with the exception of Monsieur Ratchet's valet, all the passengers are big men. The Italian, Colonel Labathnot, Hector McQueen, Count Antoine. Well, that leaves us the valet. Not a very likely supposition. But there is another possibility. Remember the womanish voice? Now, that gives us a choice of alternatives. The man may be disguised as a woman, or, alternatively, he may actually be a woman. Huh? A tall woman dressed in man's clothes would look small.
But surely Ratchet would have known...
No. Perhaps he did know. Perhaps already this woman had attempted his life wearing men's clothes, the better to accomplish her purpose. Ratchet may have guessed that she would use the same trick again, so he tells Hard Man to look for a man. But he mentions, however, a womanish voice.
It is a possibility, said Monsieur Bouc. But
listen, my friend, I think that I should now tell you of certain inconsistencies notified by Dr. Constantine.
He retailed at length the conclusions that he and the doctor had arrived at together from the nature of the dead man's wounds. Mr. Bouc groaned and held his head again.
I know, said Poirot sympathetically, I know exactly how you feel. The head spins, does it not?
Oh, the whole thing is a fantasy, cried Monsieur Bouc. Exactly. It is absurd. Improbable. It cannot be.
So I myself have said. And yet, my friends, there it is. One cannot escape from the facts.
Oh, it is madness.
Is it not? It is so mad, my friend, that sometimes I am haunted by the sensation that really it must be very simple. But that is only one of my little ideas.
Two murderers, groaned Monsieur Bouc, and on the Orient Express.
The thought almost made him weep.
And now let us make the fantasy more fantastique, said Poirot cheerfully. Last night on the train there are two mysterious strangers. There is the wagonly attendant, answering to the description given us by Monsieur Hardman, and seen by Hildegard Schmidt, Colonel Arbuthnot, and Monsieur McQueen. There is also a woman in a red kimono, a tall, slim woman seen by Pierre Michel, by Miss Debenham, by Monsieur McQueen, and by myself, and smelt, I may say, by Colonel Arbuthnot. Who was she? No one on the train admits to having a scarlet kimono. She, too, has vanished. Was she one and the same with the spurious wagonly attendant? Or was she some quite distinct personality? Where are they, these two? And incidentally, where is the wagonly uniform and the scarlet kimono?
Ah, that is something definite.
Monsieur Bouc sprang up eagerly.
We must search all the passengers' luggage. Yes, that will be something.
Poirot rose also.
I will make a prophecy, he said.
You know where they are?
Well, I have a little idea.
Where, then?
You will find the scarlet kimono in the baggage of one of the men, and you will find the uniform of the wagonly conductor in the baggage of Hildegard Schmidt.
Hildegard Schmidt? You think that...
Not what you are thinking. No. I will put it like this. If Hildegard Schmidt is guilty, the uniform might be found in her baggage. But if she is innocent, it certainly will be.
But how?
Began Monsieur Bouc and stopped.
What is this noise that approaches? He cried.
It resembles a locomotive in motion.
The noise drew nearer. It consisted of shrill cries and protests in a woman's voice. The door at the end of the dining car flew open. Mrs. Hubbard burst in.
Oh, it's too horrible, she cried. It's just too horrible. In my sponge bag, a great knife all over blood.
And suddenly toppling forward, she fainted heavily on Monsieur Bouc's shoulder. Chapter 14. The Evidence of the weapon. With more vigour than chivalry, Monsieur Bouc deposited the fainting lady with her head on the table. Dr. Constantine yelled for one of the restaurant attendants who came at a run. "Keep her head so," said the doctor. "If she revives, give her a little cognac. You understand?" Then he hurried off after the other two. His interest lay wholly in the crime. Swooning middle-aged ladies did not interest him at all. It is possible that Mrs. Hubbard revived rather quicker with these methods than she might otherwise have done. A few minutes later she was sitting up, sipping cognac from a glass proffered by the attendant, and talking once more.
"I just can't say how terrible it was. I don't suppose anybody in this train can understand my feelings. I've always been very, very sensitive ever since a child. The mere sight of blood! Oh, why, even now I come up a queer when I think about it."
The attendant proffered the glass again.
"Encore un peu, madame?"
Oh, do you think I'd better? Oh, well, I'm a lifelong teetotaler. I just never touch spirits or wine at any time. No, all my family are abstainers. Still, perhaps as this is only medical,
She sipped once more. In the meantime, Poirot and Monsieur Bouc, closely followed by Dr. Constantine, had hurried out of the restaurant car and along the corridor of the Stamboul coach towards Mrs. Hubbard's compartment. Every traveller on the train seemed to be congregated outside the door. The conductor, a harassed look on his face, was keeping them back.
"Mais il n'y a rien à voir," he said, and repeated the sentiment in several other languages. "Let me pass, if you please," said Monsieur Bouc. Squeezing his rotundity past the obstructing passengers, he entered the compartment, and Poirot close behind him.
"Oh, I am glad you have come, monsieur,"
said the conductor with a sigh of relief.
"Everyone has been trying to enter. The American lady, such screams as she gave. Ah, ma foi, I thought she too had been murdered. I came at a run, and there she was screaming like a mad woman, and she cried out that she must fetch you, and she departed, screeching at the top of her voice and telling everybody whose carriage she passed what had occurred."
He added with a gesture of the hand,
"It is in there, monsieur. I have not touched it."
Hanging on the handle of the door that gave access to the next compartment was a large-sized, checked rubber sponge bag. Below it on the floor, just where it had fallen from Mrs. Hubbard's hand, was a straight-bladed dagger. A cheap affair, sham oriental, with an embossed hilt and a tapering blade. The blade was stained with patches of what looked like rust. Poirot picked it up delicately.
"Ah, yes," he murmured. "There is no mistake. Here is our missing weapon, all right, eh, doctor?"
The doctor examined it.
"Oh, you need not be so careful," said Poirot.
"There will be no fingerprints on it save those of Mrs. Hubbard."
Constantine's examination did not take long.
"It is the weapon, all right," he said. "It would account for any of the wounds."
"Oh, I implore you, my friend, do not say that."
The doctor looked astonished.
"Already we are heavily overburdened by a coincidence. Two people decide to stab Monsieur Ratchet last night. It is too much of a good thing that each of them should select an identical weapon."
"Well, as to that, the coincidence is not perhaps so great as it seems," said the doctor. "Thousands of these sham Eastern daggers are made and shipped to the bazaars of Constantinople."
"Oh, you console me a little, but only a little," said Poirot.
He looked thoughtfully at the door in front of him, then, lifting off the sponge bag, he tried the handle. The door did not budge. About a foot above the handle was the door bolt. Poirot drew it back and tried again. But still, the door remained fast.
"No, we locked it from the other side, you remember?" said the doctor.
"Ah, that is true,"
said Poirot absently. He seemed to be thinking about something else. His brow was furrowed, as though in perplexity.
"It agrees, does it not?" said Monsieur Bouc. "The man passes through this carriage. As he shuts the communicating door behind him, he feels the sponge bag. Ah, a thought comes to him, and he quickly slips the blood-stained knife inside. Then, all unwitting that he has awakened Mrs. Hubbard, he slips out through the door into the corridor."
"As you say," murmured Poirot, "that is how it must have happened."
But the puzzled look did not leave his face.
"But what is it?" demanded Monsieur Bouc. "There is something, is there not, that does not satisfy you?"
Poirot darted a quick look at him.
"The same point does not strike you?"
No, evidently not. Well, it is a small matter.
The conductor looked into the carriage.
The American lady is coming back.
Dr. Constantine looked rather guilty. He had, he felt, treated Mrs. Hubbard rather cavalierly. But she had no reproaches for him. Her energies were concentrated on another matter.
"I'm just going on to say one thing right out,"
she said breathlessly as she arrived in the doorway.
"I'm not going on any longer in this compartment. Why, I wouldn't sleep in it tonight if you paid me $1,000,000.
"Oh, but, madame—"
"No, I know what you're going to say, and I'm telling you right now that I won't do any such thing. Why, I'd rather sit up all night in the corridor."
She began to cry.
"Oh, if my daughter could only know! If she could see me now, why—"
Poirot interrupted firmly.
"Now you misunderstand, madame. Your demand is most reasonable. Your baggage shall be changed at once to another compartment."
Mrs. Hubbard lowered her handkerchief.
"Oh, is that so? Oh, oh, I feel better right away. But surely it's all full up. Unless one of the gentlemen..."
Monsieur Bouc spoke.
"Your baggage, madame, shall be moved out of this coach altogether. You shall have a compartment in the next coach, which was put on at Belgrade."
"Oh, why, that's splendid. I'm not an out-of-the-way, nervous woman. But to sleep in that compartment next door to a dead man, oh!"
She shivered.
"It would drive me plumb crazy."
"Michel," called Monsieur Bouc, "move this baggage into a vacant compartment in the Athens-Paris coach."
"Yes, monsieur. The same one as this, the number 3?
No, said Poirot, before his friend could reply. "I think it would be better for madame to have a different number altogether. The number 12, for instance."
"Bien, monsieur."
The conductor seized the luggage. Mrs. Hubbard turned gratefully to Poirot.
"That's very kind and delicate of you. I appreciate it, I assure you."
"Ah, do not mention it, madame. We will come with you and see you comfortably installed."
Mrs. Hubbard was escorted by the 3 men to her new home. She looked round her happily.
"This is fine."
"It suits you, madame. It is, you see, exactly like the compartment you have left."
"But yes, that's so. Well, only it faces the other way. But that doesn't matter, for these trains go first one way and then the other. I said to my daughter, 'I want a carriage facing the engine.' And she said, 'Why, Mama, that'll be no good to you. For if you go to sleep one way, when you wake up, the train's going the other.' Yeah, but it was quite true, what she said. Why, last evening we went into Belgrade one way and out the other."
"Well, at any rate, madame, you are quite happy and contented now?"
"Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Here we are, stuck in a snowdrift, and nobody doing anything about it, and my boat sailing the day after tomorrow."
"Madame," said Monsieur Bouc, "we are all in the same case, every one of us."
"Well, that's true," admitted Mrs. Hubbard. "But nobody else has a murderer walking right through their compartment in the middle of the night."
"And what still puzzles me, madame," said Poirot, "is how the man got into your compartment, if the communicating door was bolted, as you say. Now, you are sure that it was bolted?"
"Why, the Swedish lady tried it before my eyes."
"Now, let us just reconstruct that little scene. You were lying in your bunk, so. And you could not see for yourself, you say."
"Well, no, because of the sponge bag." "Oh, my. I shall have to get a new sponge bag. It makes me feel sick in my stomach to look at this one."
Poirot picked up the sponge bag and hung it on the handle of the communicating door into the next carriage.
"Precisément. I see," he said. "The bolt is just underneath the handle. The sponge bag masks it. You could not see from where you were lying whether the bolt were turned or not."
"Why, that's just what I've been telling you."
"And the Swedish lady, Miss Olsen, stood so between you and the door. She tried it and told you it was bolted."
"That's so."
"All the same, madame, she may have made an error. You see what I mean?"
Poirot seemed anxious to explain.
"The bolt is just a projection of metal, so. Turn to the right, the door is locked. Left straight, it is not. Possibly she merely tried the door, and as it was locked on the other side, she may have assumed it was locked on your side."
Well, I guess that would be rather stupid of her.
Madame, the most kind, the most amiable, are not always the cleverest.
Yeah, but that's so, of course.
By the way, madame, did you travel out to Smyrna this way?
No, I sailed right to Stamboul. And a friend of my daughter's, Mr. Johnson, oh, perfectly lovely man, I'd like to have you know him, met me and showed me all around Stamboul, which I found a very disappointing city, all tumbling down. And as for those masks and putting on those great shuffling things over your shoes, and, oh, where was I?
You were saying that Mr. Johnson met you.
Oh, yes, that's so. And he saw me on board a French messagerie boat for Smyrna, and my daughter's husband was waiting right on the quay. What he'll say when he hears about all this? My daughter said this would be just the safest, easiest way imaginable. You just sit in your carriage, she said, and you get right to Paris, and there the American Express will meet you. And, oh, dear, what am I to do about canceling my steamship passage? I ought to let them know. Well, I can't possibly make it now. This is just too terrible.
Mrs. Hubbard showed signs of tears once more. Poirot, who had been fidgeting slightly, seized his opportunity.
Now, you have had a shock, madame. The restaurant attendant shall be instructed to bring you along some tea and some biscuits.
Well, I don't know that I'm so set on tea,
said Mrs. Hubbard tearfully.
That's more an English habit.
Coffee, then, madame? You need some stimulant.
Well, that cognac's made my head feel mighty funny. Yeah, I think I would like some coffee.
Excellent. You must revive your forces.
My, what a funny expression.
But first, madame, a little matter of routine. You permit that I make a search of your baggage?
Whatever for?
Well, we are about to commence a search of all the passengers' luggage. I do not want to remind you of an unpleasant experience, but your sponge bag, remember?
Mercy. Perhaps you'd better. I just couldn't bear to get any more surprises of that kind.
The examination was quickly over. Mrs. Hubbard was travelling with the minimum of luggage, a hatbox, a cheap suitcase, and a well-burdened travelling bag. The contents of all three were simple and straightforward, and the examination would not have taken more than a couple of minutes, had not Mrs. Hubbard delayed matters by insisting on due attention being paid to photographs of my daughter, and two rather ugly children.
My daughter's children. Aren't they cunning?
Chapter 15. The Evidence of the Passenger's Luggage. Having delivered himself of various polite insincerities, and having told Mrs. Hubbard that he would order coffee to be brought to her, Poirot was able to take his leave accompanied by his two friends.
"Well, we have made a start and drawn a blank," observed Monsieur Bouc. "Whom shall we tackle next?"
"It would be simplest, I think, just to proceed along the train carriage by carriage. That means we start with number 16, the amiable Mr. Hardman."
Mr. Hardman, who was smoking a cigar, welcomed them affably.
"Ah, come right in, gentlemen. That is, if it's humanly possible. It's just a mite cramped in here for a party."
Monsieur Bouc explained the object of their visit, and the big detective nodded comprehendingly.
"That's okay. To tell the truth, I've been wondering you didn't get down to it sooner. Here are my keys, gentlemen, and if you would like to search my pockets too, why, you're welcome. Shall I reach the grips down for you?"
"Oh, no. The conductor will do that. Michel?"
The contents of Mr. Hardman's two grips were soon examined and passed. They contained perhaps an undue proportion of spirituous liquor. Mr. Hardman winked.
"Well, it's not often they search your grips at the frontiers. Not if you fix the conductor. I handed out a wad of Turkish notes right away, and there's been no trouble so far."
"And at Paris?"
Mr. Hardman winked again.
"By the time I get to Paris," he said, "what's left over of this little lot will go into a bottle labeled hair wash."
So you are not a believer in prohibition, Monsieur Hardman," said Monsieur Bouc with a smile.
"Well," said Hardman, "I can't say prohibition has ever worried me any."
"Ah," said Monsieur Bouc. "The speakeasy, huh?"
He pronounced the word with care, savoring it.
"Your American terms are so quaint, so expressive," he said.
"Me, I would much like to go to America,"
said Poirot.
"Yeah, well, you'd learn a few go-ahead methods over there," said Hartman. "Europe wants waking up. She's half asleep."
"Well, yeah, it is true that America is the country of progress," agreed Poirot. "There is much that I admire about Americans, only I am perhaps old-fashioned. But me, I find the American woman less charming than my own countrywoman, yeah? The French or Belgian girl, coquettish, charming. I think there is no one to touch her."
Hardman turned away to peer out at the snow for a minute.
"Ah, yeah, perhaps you're right, Monsieur Poirot," he said. "But I guess, well, every nation likes its own girls best."
He blinked as though the snow hurt his eyes.
"Yeah, kind of dazzling, isn't it?" he remarked. Now, say, gentlemen, this business is getting on my nerves. Murder and the snow and all and nothing doing, you know? Just hanging about and killing time? I'd like to get busy after someone or something." "Ah, the true Western spirit of hustle," said Poirot with a smile.
The conductor replaced the bags, and they moved on to the next compartment. The colonel was sitting in a corner smoking a pipe and reading a magazine. Poirot explained their errand. The colonel made no demur. He had two heavy leather suitcases.
"The rest of my kit has gone by long sea," he explained.
Like most army men, the colonel was a neat packer. The examination of his baggage took only a few minutes. Poirot noted a packet of pipe cleaners.
"Ah, you always use the same kind?" he asked. "Yeah, usually, if I can get them."
"Ah," Poirot nodded. These pipe cleaners were identical with the one he had found on the floor of the dead man's compartment. Dr. Constantine remarked as much when they were out in the corridor again.
"Tout de même," murmured Poirot. "I can hardly believe it. It is not dans son caractère. And when you have said that, you have said everything."
The door of the next compartment was closed. It was that occupied by Princess Dragomirov. They knocked on the door, and the princess's deep voice called,
"Entrez!"
Monsieur Bouc was spokesman. He was very deferential and polite as he explained their errand. The princess listened to him in silence, her small, toad-like face quite impassive.
"If it is necessary, monsieur," she said quietly when he had finished, "that is all there is to it. My maid has the keys. She will attend to it with you."
"Does your maid always carry your keys, madame?" asked Poirot.
"Certainly, monsieur."
"And if during the night at one of the frontiers the customs officials should require a piece of luggage to be opened?"
The old lady shrugged her shoulders.
"It is very unlikely, but in such a case this conductor would fetch her."
"You trust her, then, implicitly, madame?"
"I have told you so already," said the princess quietly. "I do not employ people whom I do not trust."
"Ah, yes," said Poirot thoughtfully. "Trust is indeed something in these days, eh? It is perhaps better to have a homely woman whom one can trust than a mere chic maid, for example, some smart Parisienne."
He saw the dark, intelligent eyes come slowly round and fasten themselves upon his face.
"What exactly are you implying, Monsieur Poirot?"
"Oh, nothing, madame. Nothing.
But yet, you think, do you not, that I should have a smart French woman to attend to my toilette?"
"Well, it would be perhaps more usual, madame."
She shook her head.
"Schmidt is devoted to me?"
Her voice dwelt lingeringly on the words.
"Devotion, c'est impayable."
The German woman had arrived with the keys. The princess spoke to her in her own language, telling her to open the valises and help the gentlemen in their search. She herself remained in the corridor looking out at the snow, and Poirot remained with her, leaving Monsieur Bouc to the task of searching the luggage. She regarded him with a grim smile.
"Well, monsieur, do you not wish to see what my valises contain?"
He shook his head.
"Madame, it is a formality, that is all."
"Are you so sure?"
"In your case, yes."
"And yet I knew and loved Sonia Armstrong. What do you think, then?
that I would not soil my hands with killing such canaille as that man Cassetti? Well, perhaps you are right.
She was silent a minute or two, and then she said,
With such a man as that, do you know what I should have liked to have done? I should have liked to call to my servants, flog this man to death, and fling him out on the rubbish heap. That is the way things were done when I was young, monsieur.
Still, he did not speak, just listened attentively. She looked at him with a sudden impetuosity.
You do not say anything, Monsieur Poirot. What is it that you are thinking, I wonder?
He looked at her with a very direct glance.
I think, madame, that your strength is in your will, not in your arm.
She glanced down at her thin black-clad arms ending in those claw-like yellow hands with the rings on the fingers.
It is true, she said. I have no strength in these. None. I do not know if I am sorry or glad.
Then she turned abruptly back towards her carriage, where the maid was busily packing up the cases. The princess cut short Monsieur Bouc's apologies.
There is no need for you to apologize, monsieur, she said. A murder has been committed. Certain actions have to be performed. That is all there is to it.
Vous êtes bien aimable, madame.
She inclined her head slightly as they departed. The doors of the next two carriages were shut. Monsieur Bouc paused and scratched his head.
Diable, he said. This may be awkward. He's a diplomatic passport. The bagage is exempt.
From customs examination, yes, but the murder is different.
I know. All the same, we do not want to have complications.
Now do not distress yourself, my friend. The Count and Countess will be reasonable. See how amiable Princess Dragomirov was about it.
Oh, she is truly grande dame. These two are also of the same position, but the Count impressed me as a man of somewhat truculent disposition. He was not pleased when you insisted on questioning his wife, eh? And this will annoy him still further. Suppose, we omit them. After all, they can have nothing to do with the matter. Why should I stir up needless trouble for myself?
Now, I do not agree with you, said Poirot. I feel sure that Count Andranier will be reasonable. At any rate, let us make the attempt.
And before Monsieur Bouc could reply, he rapped sharply on the door of number 13. A voice from within cried,
Entrez!
The Count was sitting in the corner near the door reading a newspaper. The Countess was curled up in the opposite corner near the window. There was a pillow behind her head, and she seemed to have been asleep.
Pardon, Monsieur le Comte, began Poirot. Pray forgive this intrusion. It is that we are making a search of all the baggage on the train, and in most cases a mere formality, but it has to be done. Monsieur Bouc suggests that, as you have a diplomatic passport, you might reasonably claim to be exempt from such a search.
The Count considered for a moment.
Thank you, he said. But I do not think that I care for an exception to be made in my case. No, I should prefer that our baggage should be examined like that of the other passengers.
He turned to his wife.
You do not object, I hope, Elena?
Not at all,
said the Countess without hesitation. A rapid and somewhat perfunctory search followed. Poirot seemed to be trying to mask an embarrassment in making various small, pointless remarks, such as,
Oh, here is a label all wet on your suitcase, madame,
as he lifted down a blue morocco case with initials on it and a coronet. The Countess did not reply to this observation. She seemed, indeed, rather bored by the whole proceeding, remained curled up in her corner, staring dreamily out through the window whilst the men searched her luggage in the compartment next door. Poirot finished his search by opening the little cupboard above the washbasin and taking a rapid glance at its contents. A sponge, face cream, powder, and a small bottle labelled Trionol. Then, with polite remarks on either side, the search party withdrew. Mrs. Hubbard's compartment, that of the dead man, and Poirot's own, came next. They now came to the second-class carriages. The first one, numbers 10 and 11, was occupied by Mary Debenham, who was reading a book, and Greta Olsen, who was fast asleep but woke with a start at their entrance. Poirot repeated his formula. The Swedish lady seemed agitated, Mary Debenham calmly indifferent. Poirot addressed himself to the Swedish lady.
"If you permit, mademoiselle, we will examine your baggage first, and then perhaps you would be so good as to see how the American lady is getting on. We have moved her into one of the carriages in the next coach, but she is still very upset as a result of her discovery. I have ordered coffee to be sent to her, but I think she is of those to whom someone to talk to is a necessity of the first water."
The good lady was instantly sympathetic. She would go immediately. It must have been indeed a terrible shock to the nerves, and already the poor lady was upset by the journey, and leaving her daughter, and, yes, certainly she would go at once. Her case was not locked, and she would take with her some sal ammoniac. She bustled off. Her possessions were soon examined. They were meagre in the extreme. She had evidently not yet noticed the missing wires from the hat-box. Miss Debenham had put her book down. She was watching Poirot. When he asked her, she handed over her keys. Then, as he lifted down a case and opened it, she said, "Why did you send her away, Monsieur Poirot?"
"I, mademoiselle, why, to minister to the American lady?"
"An excellent pretext, but a pretext all the same."
"I don't understand you, mademoiselle."
"No, I think you understand me very well." She smiled.
"You wanted to get me alone. Wasn't that it?" "Oh, you are putting words into my mouth, mademoiselle."
"And ideas into your head?"
"No, I don't think so.
The ideas are already there." "That is right, isn't it?"
"Mademoiselle, we have a proverb."
"Qui s'excuse, s'accuse. Is that what you were going to say? You must give me the credit for a certain amount of observation and common sense. For some reason or other, you've got it into your head that I know something about this sordid business, this murder of a man I never saw before."
"Oh, you are imagining things, mademoiselle."
"No, I'm not imagining things at all. But it seems to me that a lot of time is wasted by not speaking the truth, by beating about the bush instead of coming straight out with things."
"Ah, and you do not like the waste of time?"
"No.
You like to come straight to the point. You like the direct method." "Eh bien, I will give it to you, the direct method. I will ask you the meaning of certain words that I overheard on the journey from Syria, I had got out of the train to do what the English call stretch the legs at the station of Konya. Your voice sent the colonels, mademoiselle. They came to me out of the night. You said to him, 'Not now, not now, when it's all over, when it's behind us.' Now, what did you mean by those words, mademoiselle?"
She said very quietly, "Do you think I meant murder?" End of side 4.